Hello and welcome there again to another episode of the Cliff Notes podcast, where we ask a leader and find their way. I'm Tristan Bailey, and I'm joined today by Adam Bardstock, founder of Small 99, and his goal is to get to 1 million small businesses to net zero by 2025, giving practical advice to small businesses in their transition. Hello today, Adam.
Good morning. Good to be here. Yes, yeah, so I was in Brighton for quite a few years, but then moved up to Glasgow last year, just at the start of start of summer last year, which has been good. It's been good to see it come back open alive and everything as lockdown's eased. So nice to see things going on. And there's a lot of stuff in the net zero space here as well. So it's a real good timing on that front as well, which is mostly accidental, but working out well so far.
No, that's cool. So, I mean, let's just go and jump into that. If you could just give us a little sort of sense of your background and what's brought you into that sort of net zero space and that focus on improving businesses.
Yeah, so just to give a bit of a very brief life story, I guess, is the past 8 years or so I've been working in e-commerce, so typically working with small businesses, less than 9 employees. Again, that's always been my world of both when I was employed with about 3 different companies for a couple of years, and then left and started my own thing, doing digital marketing for e-commerce companies, but as a freelancer. And my market was always looking at those small business owners and going, you know, what are their challenges? What are their troubles? And let's go to conferences like Brighton SEO and all these big publishing houses and all this big information that's coming out there, and distill that down and reformat that so that it's more practical and applicable for small business owners. I've been doing that for, you know, 8 years or so. That's always been the approach of, okay, how do we take this complex information that is out there and make it more applicable and useful for small companies who have limited resources? Moving into this net zero space, the approach is essentially the same. The target market is the same, right? Net zero is an incredibly complex and incredibly overwhelming topic that a lot of businesses are struggling to get hold of. And the answer there is either you pay a consultant and a large company a lot of money to come in and help you understand that, or you have to try and find out that information yourself. And the information that was out there was all fairly, I want to say, inappropriate, where a lot of it was talking of, well, speak to your team. It's like, well, what if I don't have a set of teams or a team? What if it's only 2 or 3 people in a small business? How can these people get to net zero? So the reason why I've kind of moved into this space as well is that 99% of the UK economy is less than 49 employees. 96% of the UK economy is less than 9 employees. So, and I think it's about 75% is a solo founder or solo director. So these companies make up the majority of the economy. Most of the economy is a small business, and therefore they need either practical digital marketing advice, which was, you know, my previous haunt, or now what I'm trying to move into is go, how do we get this majority of the economy and how do we mobilize them towards net zero and start helping them reduce their emissions with practical advice that isn't behind expensive consultants or behind just a sheer mountain of information, which is really overwhelming. So that's where I've kind of got to and started on that probably about 18 months ago, a year ago. And yeah, it's been going really well so far. I've been enjoying it. And there's a lot out there to do, and there's a lot of information to distill and take apart, but you know, it needs doing. And it's the same approach as the e-commerce stuff, really, but just in a newer sector.
And just before we unpack what that sort of net zero statement means to you, the UK government passed laws in 2019. They wanted to be one of the first to set the laws in place to get all greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2050. But you're pulling forwards your target for getting to 1 million businesses that you've helped by 2025. I mean, what's pulled you to sort of that earlier goal, or why the 1 million?
It's a good question. I think the energy behind that statement is really important in that small business owners can take action quickly. If I go to KPMG or, you know, this massive corporation and go, well, even looking at a digital marketing point of view, let's do this SEO campaign, that has to get signed off by a number of people, and that can take half a year before it actually starts acting. And that's on something that we know they know how to do, and that's going to make them money. With environmental action, big companies are even more cautious about doing these things because it's going to take more time. Small business owners don't have that problem. There is an opportunity there for them to move much quicker here. The idea of going to a small business owner and saying, you've got 9 years to change who you buy your envelopes from, just seems a little bit insane, because they can do that within a month or within an hour, let alone they'd have to wait for 9 years to start making those impacts. So it's really that thing saying halving our emissions by 2030 is just uninspiring, and businesses aren't going to do it. They'll wait to 2029 before they actually do it. 2025, I think, is far more practical, and it does depend on the business. Some businesses are going to be more difficult, and I think manufacturing probably is one of those ones where it is a bit more tricky. But if you look at a lot of the businesses out there who are maybe digital marketing agencies or people working from home or, you know, shopkeepers and things like that, they've not necessarily got a huge carbon footprint anyway. You know, their footprints are going to be fairly modest, and therefore they can tackle that relatively cheaply, relatively quickly, and they can grow as a result of the actions they take within that. So the idea behind 2025 is just to move the conversation on and go, look, we're not talking about vague targets in the future that no one really cares about, no one's actually going to look at. how do we take this more seriously and start making a real dent in the carbon emissions? Because in the next 6 months, you can actually reduce your emissions down by a good percentage. And that percentage is going to change depending on the company. However, that doesn't mean that you can't get started today and just get on with it and stop faffing around.
And just to pick on something you said there, a reasonable target. I mean, what is a quantifiable amount and what makes it reasonable or unreasonable? And then knowing what's a reasonable change to make on that. Are these all abstract numbers or have you got some stuff that can help people put that into some context of what they should be looking for?
That's a really good question and it's a very difficult answer to give. So I think taking a step back, looking at a carbon footprint. So the personal carbon footprint of the average UK citizen is something like 12 tons. So most people in the UK's footprint based on, you know, average diets and all that stuff will be between 10 and 12 tons. That sort of figure doesn't really exist for companies. I looked into it to try and get an idea of, okay, so let's look at small companies. What is the average carbon footprint of a small company in the UK? Now, the official data for that only looks at scope 1 and 2 emissions, which we'll come on to a bit later. But, you know, those are basically how much the energy being consumed. So there's a lot of data around that and the amount of mileage you're doing in vehicles. And again, there's a lot of data around that. The third section, which is the scope 3 emissions, which is your supply chain, there's basically no information for, and that will account for 90% or more of a small business's carbon footprint. So in terms of the data that's out there, there isn't really anything. And I think the figure that we did look at this, if you took the official data and did a carbon footprint assessment, it came out about 4 tons of CO2 a year for a small business. Now that just seems so small and so wrong that it can't be correct. And even if you, having spoken to a couple of carbon footprint consultants and asked, like, what is the smallest footprint you've ever come out with for a company? I think it came out at around 20 tons. So already, based on the data we have, it's out by a magnitude of 5. And that's kind of the best case scenario. So really, this is a big challenge we have, is because of the lack of policy and because of the lack of frameworks out there for businesses to report on. And because there's only a small early minority who are really interested in doing these carbon footprint measurements, then we still have limited data that is accessible to everyone to understand what a footprint is.
Holding Bay specializes in working with B2B companies, like manufacturers, to build better solutions and drive better sales funnels. So if you would like to build a web application or improve your branding and sales funnel, get in contact today. holdingbay.co.uk or call us on 01273 0440.
I was just going to say very quickly, things like changing energy supplier, we know those are easy things to do that will make a fairly big impact because energy is going to be roughly a third of your emissions. So there are some things we can look at and go, well, percentage terms, we know this is going to make a big dent. And again, manufacturing is going to look very different to a digital marketing agency, but it's still both of those companies are using an energy provider. So that is something we could take action on.
Just to keep establishing what it is we're looking at. I mean, when you're talking about tons, is this like how much recycling you're doing, like the weight of something? Is it a physical thing that we're offsetting or is it a calculation that we're putting together based on production? Where's this coming from?
Yes, it's a good question. So let me just define net zero very briefly and kind of pull it apart. So net zero is essentially the balance between your emissions and your offsetting activity. So right now, today, your company might be emitting 100 tons of CO2. You then might reduce that down to 20 tons of CO2, and then you will offset and buy credits for the remaining 20 tons of CO2 that you've got. And therefore, that will then achieve a balance of you're buying 20 tons of CO2 credits and you're emitting 20 tons of CO2. Therefore, you are net zero because you have reached a break-even point in your emissions. By emissions, we define that, and this is where net zero does differ from some other things like carbon neutral or zero carbon. It takes into account all greenhouse gases. So that includes nitrous oxide, methane, as well as carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is always going to be the biggest emission source there. It's always that, you know, the biggest pool of those emissions. But, and again, that's going to vary on sector because something like farming is going to, you know, produce far more nitrate and methane emissions than another company that's just buying in mugs to resell online. So the important thing with net zero is that it is all greenhouse gas emissions. And also to reach net zero, you need to have demonstrated reductions. So reduction really is key here. Something like carbon neutral is where a company, if you're emitting 100 tons of CO2, you can just go and buy 100 tons worth of credits today and then claim you're carbon neutral. So that isn't particularly helpful because carbon offsetting and carbon credits have their own challenges and don't all, you know, there is a question there of how effective they actually are. And the answer is not very. So demonstrating reduction really is the key with net zero in that you need to reduce it down. Now, when I say tons of CO2, we know that carbon dioxide has a global warming potential, a GWP of 1. Methane and nitrous oxide have different global warming potential figures. I think methane is about 30 times as bad. Nitrous oxide is 300 times as bad, but you normally produce it in much smaller quantities. The idea behind carbon dioxide equivalent as a metric or as a term equates all of those different methanes into the same metric so that you're always comparing the same level. And that is what defines that tonnage. So when I'm talking about let's offset 20 tons of CO2, it's actually, you know, buying 20 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent because that's going to include methane and nitrous oxide and stuff. Does all that make sense? I'm not sure if I've just ranted and it's maybe...
No, it does. It does. I like that clarification of that it's pulling together some different things into a single figure. So it's a single number. Just to come back to my understanding, because sometimes like if you fly in planes and some different sources, they will offer you to offset stuff. Are you saying that offsetting might be some part of the picture, but that's not really the answer? It's more getting back a handle on it and reducing it?
Yeah, it's a difficult one because it's always easier to not do damage in the first place than it is to repair that damage. So it's far easier not to go and break your car windscreen than it is to break it and then get an exact replacement put in that works the same as the old windscreen. That's essentially the problem with carbon emissions, is that a carbon offsetting is far better that you don't take the flight than it is you try and carbon offset that flight. Because one, as you say, if you're booking a flight with EasyJet, they'll have a little tick box that says, do you want to carbon offset your flight? And it'll be a nominal amount of money. It'll be like £5 or so. And that is clearly just not enough in terms of the damage that is being done. So to put into perspective, I think like a flight from London to Glasgow is around 300 kilos of CO2. It's something around that, you know, 300-400. So it's about half, you know, it's less than half a ton. And that's one way. So a return flight is probably going to be about a ton of CO2. And therefore, you can buy, you know, in theory, you can plant a tree for that, which over its lifetime is going to offset that amount of carbon produced. And that offset is going to cost around £5 for you to plant a tree, because trees are fairly cheap to plant. And normally this is going to be in a developing country where labor is cheaper. That's the idea behind carbon offsetting. And there are other methods of carbon offsetting, which I don't want to go into too much, but let's take tree planting as an example here. The problem with tree planting and relying on it and going, well, actually, so I've bought this flight and I've offset it, therefore it's good, therefore I've neutralized my impact that is negative there. The problem then is, what if that tree doesn't grow? How do you know that tree is being planted that is actually being planted because of you paying for it and not because it's a scheme that already existed? So there's that idea of additionality, is you need to have a tree that is planted above and beyond what is already being done in these regenerative schemes. What if that tree, as I said, doesn't grow, or is part of a forest fire, or is part of flooding, or gets eaten by an animal, or anything like that? And there's a real good article that came out, I think yesterday actually, in Vox, called, that was looking at the issue of these mass planting initiatives where people are focusing their metric on tree planting and not tree growing, which I thought was a really nice way of looking at it, where I think it was in Turkey in 2017, they planted 1 million trees. And a report looked into it, and 2 years later, 90% of those trees had failed to grow because of, you know, just lack of rain, too much heat. They were planted at the wrong time of year. They were the wrong type of tree to plant, and all these different issues. So they weren't planted for carbon offsetting, but there's a question there of, okay, well, let's say I've just bought 1 million trees to offset my carbon footprint of 1 million tons. 90% of those haven't actually grown. So then it's actually only 100,000 tons of my emissions have been offset, but I'm still emitting 1 million tons a year of CO2. So this is why reduction is so important, because reducing the amount of damage you're doing is always going to be more beneficial than it is trying to undo that damage that is really hard to undo, because it's such a, you know, you're borrowing it from the future. We don't really have a future to borrow from in terms of carbon emissions. We need to stop doing it as soon as possible.
Yeah. I mean, just in a more sort of that sort of practical in front of you sense, and like you said with the windows, I mean, but if you spill over your coffee or spill oil on the floor in the workshop or something, it's going to take you time to clean it up, and you can sort of quantify how long that's going to take and how much paper or sand or whatever it's going to need to clean it up. But you're not 100% sure you've got it back to the original condition it was before you spilt it all over the place. And it's also taking you the time to solve it.
Exactly. The way I like to think about it, kind of the image I also have in my head here, is like, imagine you've got a nice little garden and you just go out and you dig a hole. That hole is you creating carbon emissions. And then to offset it, you've got to put that soil back in the same way so that it looks like the hole was never buried in the first place. That's a really difficult thing to do, because you can do it and you can put the soil back, but then it's not going to look quite right. It's not going to be quite the same level of pristine lawn as it was before. And it's very difficult to restore it. As you say, if you spill a coffee in the workshop, you're never going to get that coffee back in the cup. It's really difficult for you to try and restore things back to how they should be. It's far easier just not to, you know, throw the coffee on the floor in the first place, or not to dig the hole. I think offsetting is, there are good schemes out there and there is a lot of good work being done, don't get me wrong, but relying on it too much is what the real issue is that, you know, a company claiming to be carbon neutral today because they've just bought a bunch of offsets. I don't really like that, because I'd rather see that they actually had a list of things they were looking at to reduce, and the actions they'd taken there, they were either looking at immediately or getting stuck in and involved with. Just relying on offset is just lazy.
Before we get into what can you do to get hands-on and change something today, I mean, how do we know what our benchmark is? What number are we looking at the moment? You said it was hard to find averages and sort of market numbers, but how do we work it out for our own business, or where should we start?
Yeah, again, really good and difficult question to answer. So I think the main thing to do is to get a really accurate idea. You need to get a carbon footprint consultant or someone in who will do an audit on your business. So similar to every year, you've got an accountant that will come in and do a tax return. You need to do a carbon assessment on your business and therefore have an idea of how much carbon you're creating. To get an accurate figure of that, there's three ways of doing it, essentially. The most difficult and most accurate method is by paying someone to come in and just do an activity-based audit of your business. That activity method means that they are looking at what you're doing, what activities your business is operating on a daily basis to understand what that carbon footprint is. There are less accurate ways of measuring it as well, which are still useful in different contexts. So there's also an accounts-based method or a spend-based method where they look at your financial spend and go, right, you're spending, you know, £1,000 a month on a paper supplier. Therefore, we can kind of guess that based on an average lifetime life cycle assessment data of an A4 piece of paper, you're buying this much paper. And therefore, just by looking at your accounts data, we can get a rough estimate of where your money's going and therefore where your carbon is being produced as well to meet those demands. Now, that's never going to be 100% accurate, but you know, there's clever software and there's algorithms and all that stuff that we can put together to get a rough idea of what that will look like. And, you know, worst case scenario is the data is bad, but it starts a conversation, because if you're reporting every quarter or every month on how much your revenues are doing, you can quite quickly and easily, therefore, also include CO2 equivalent metrics there and say, this is what our carbon footprint looks like roughly. The third idea here really is around just not needing to get started or not needing to measure your footprint to get started. So there's a lot of actions we know that will reduce your carbon footprint. So not flying, not driving, reducing the amount of energy you're consuming, reducing the amount of gas you're using, reducing the amount of materials you're using. All these things we know are going to reduce your footprint, because less consumption typically means kind of less carbon footprint, but also more profit for your business, which again, we'll come on to later. But I think this is where it gets difficult, because some companies, if they've got money behind them, the answer is essentially you should just get a carbon footprint audit done, because that's going to be a really accurate way to understand where your emissions are sitting and you can demonstrate bigger reductions there. However, I think that might also be a barrier to entry for a lot of businesses who are perhaps a bit smaller and don't have a few £1,000s to spend on that. So then the advice becomes almost don't measure your carbon footprint now. Start reducing it down. Just get, you know, actually get involved and start doing this, because it's going to save you money in the long run. And then measure it at a point where you're more invested in it and you're more educated and more involved with that process. And then measure it at that point when you're going to get more value out of it.
Mm-hmm. I like that, especially because you came back to, and was one of my other questions I had for you. Well, I mean, what is the benefit of this? I mean, is this going to make us more money? Is it going to help the company grow? Or is it the sort of thing that's slowing us down? Because a certain amount of simple thinking is, if I press down on an accelerator, I go faster, but I'm using more fuel. If I don't accelerate, I'm not going anywhere. So, are we still accelerating? Are we still able to grow? Or is this going to hamper us by trying to aim for this? What's the goal and what's the payoff?
My biggest frustration really is that net zero is always seen as a barrier to growth, or it's a separate activity to growth, when really it is intrinsic to growth. It is something that goes hand in hand with it. I think manufacturing is a good example. Someone was on a call a couple of weeks ago. They run, I can't remember what they made, but they ran a warehouse up in Leicestershire, and they'd invested over a couple of years a lot of time and money in tooling to reduce the amount of materials that we're using. So the process became more efficient. Now that did have an initial cost to it, but it now means that they are far more profitable because they're using an industry leading level of material that is normally wasted. And you know, they've reduced that right down and they've now got a really efficient process. They are now making more money as a result. I think they also said they'd put in a bunch of solar panels on their business. So again, their energy bills have reduced, and certainly looking at the minute with gas problems in the UK, they will have mitigated a lot of that risk, and they're not as susceptible to market conditions now because they've got electric boilers and electric heating. And so they're generating their own power and they've removed themselves from that as well. That did have a cost to it, don't get me wrong, but they are now a more profitable company as a result, and they're seeing profit margins higher than they ever would have done without that investment. Those things, and there are very good cases to be made for all of those investments without ever mentioning the environment, without ever mentioning net zero. I think that's one part of it, is typically the path to net zero is reduce your consumption. Consumption is normally tied to cost. Therefore, reduction of consumption is going to save you money. Therefore, achieving net zero is going to increase your profit margins because you're spending less money on stuff that you don't need. So that's a very basic idea behind a lot of net zero stuff.
Simple formulas, we like that.
Yeah, exactly. It's the simplest I've managed to get it. The other stuff you can look at is more regulatory and then kind of business growth. So carbon taxes, they're likely to come down in the future, and certainly in industries that are already there. So steel production, for example, that's quite heavily taxed at the minute based on the amount of carbon that produces. So there is, and there's talk of, you know, where do we have carbon border taxes, where at the minute producing steel in the UK is going to cost more than producing steel in China, because the steel from China isn't being taxed on those carbon emissions. That's a bit more difficult to get to grips with, and it's a bit more intangible, because I think carbon taxes are something that is a future threat. It's going to come down the line at some point, but right now it's not really a thing unless you're in very specific industries. But again, that's another argument I would make, is that reducing your emissions down now is going to reduce your risk to a legislative change in the future, and it just makes you a bit more resilient in that sense. I think, and then the third one is around this idea of growth. And as more people get on board with net zero, the more and more people are going to be asking your supply chain of net zero. And certainly in procurement and public contracts, we're starting to see this come through already, where public sector organizations are asking for the environmental policy and the net zero commitments of their supply chain, because they need to demonstrate legally that they are doing something for net zero. Now, that also happens to big companies. There's a thing called the Task Force for Climate Disclosures. I think it's TCFD or TCFD. It's one of the two. But essentially, that, again, is a legal framework that goes to big companies and works with corporate clients, going, well, what is your risk exposure to climate change for the next 50 years? And yes, they are going to have these longer net zero targets because they're bigger companies. But the idea being there, you know, if Unilever can't grow the food it needs to make Marmite or to make, you know, one of their brand products, they physically can't grow that because of climate change. They don't have a product to sell, and therefore they can't make money, and therefore investors are going to have a bad time. They need to know that their exposure to climate change in the future is accounted in now, and that they are doing stuff to address that. And again, part of that is looking at their supply chain, because even companies like Starbucks, Tesco, all these big conglomerates, their scope 3 emissions are typically 90% or more as well. So their supply chain is creating a lot of the emissions, and therefore they need to reduce that down and reduce their supply chain risk. And that means going to companies that are of medium size and eventually of small size, going, what's your net zero goals? Where's your environmental policy? Where are your targets? And that's where we're starting to see the knock-on effect. So to bring it back to the point of growth and going, you know, is net zero a threat or an opportunity? If you're sat in a room and you're bidding for a contract with a company, and there's three of you, and two of those people don't have an environmental policy, but you're there saying, well, here's our environmental policy, here's the things that we've done and we're doing to reduce our carbon footprint down, and we've set a net zero target of 2025, that's going to be a far more emotionally reassuring thing for the person who you're bidding for the work from to hear, because it means that you're not going to be a problem in the future. And as we kind of develop down this path and more net zero stuff comes in, I think there's going to be a lot more companies that are not going to be willing to take on a company who risks increasing their carbon footprint. So why would Tesco's or Starbucks or anyone who's got kind of quite a strong, transparent environmental policy, why are they going to start working with companies who are risking to increase their carbon footprint? Because that's going to undo work, and it's going to just make their jobs more difficult. So really aligning that supply chain is going to become a point of growth. And I don't think we're there yet. And I am talking to this in a fairly theoretical level, but these conversations are happening now in some rooms, and it's only going to get louder.
Yeah. Is that what resonates with Mark Carney at the Bank of England, that companies that don't adapt to the climate crisis will go bankrupt without question? Is that resonating with you for what you've just said there?
Yeah, I think there's plenty of Mark Carney quotes, which I think really do resonate with this. And it's, you know, adapt or die, because this isn't going away. One of the courses I did for climate change at Cambridge started with a really good quote, which is, we'll either achieve net zero through policy or through kind of natural correction. There is no alternative. Either this is going to get really, really bad and, you know, carbon emissions will stabilize because we physically can't produce it anymore, because people are, you know, either all the machines are underwater, or we achieve this through policy and we actually start managing this and we take control of our future and be more responsible with it, which is quite an extreme stance to take. But I think I quite liked it. It's just that, you know, you've got two options here. You either adapt or die. So
no, I'm happy being on board with that idea. I mean, now could we just move over into being more proactive? And what could we get on with in our business today? You said there might be sort of small things we could look at, but are there any small pieces, or are there initiatives that work out from government support or other agencies that can help us move forward and navigate this a little bit?
Yeah. Where to start with that question? I think in terms of government support, there's not a huge amount, I don't think, or that there is, but it's at quite a big level. So if you're developing a new carbon sequestering device technology and you're transitioning from an oil and gas company into something else that does more carbon capture and storage, there is money for it, but it's all fairly big projects. For most small companies who are, I don't know what the cutoff would really be, but all of the support that I've seen tends to be in the tens of thousands, or mostly in the hundreds and millions of pounds. So unless you're doing really big stuff, there's not a huge amount of support out there. However, this comes back to my previous point, is that a lot of these actions will actually save you money, and they will reduce your costs down rather than increase them. So I wouldn't be too disheartened, and I don't think finance is always necessarily the right answer to this. I think it's more about clarity of action and what people can do. So I think the first thing I would recommend companies do is just start thinking about this on a daily basis. Net zero is a journey. This isn't a one-off thing that's going to be done quickly. It's something that is going to take, you know, it's going to take you a couple of years to achieve. And it can be quick, and you can achieve it in 12 months if you really put a lot of effort and money behind it. But it is going to be something that is never really done until quite a, you know, a few years down the line. So the first thing, I think, is just change your mindset to start thinking about the carbon cost of anything that you're doing in your business. So that is from, well, the way I like to put it is the envelope test, right? So rather than going and just buying the envelopes off eBay or wherever you get them from at the minute and just ordering more, you want to stop yourself and go, one, actually, that's an assumption, is that I need envelopes. Is there not another way that I could reduce my consumption of envelopes down, save this cost, and maybe do things in a slightly different way to do it? So one is that, you know, challenging the assumption of business as usual. And secondly, if you do need envelopes, okay, that's fine. You do need to run a business, but where can you get them from that is going to be more environmentally sustainable? So how do you align your supply chain then with other people who are trying to achieve net zero? If you can find an envelope supplier who is also on that journey to net zero and they have strong net zero commitments, as they do their work and as they progress on their journey, your carbon footprint is also going to be increasing and reduced down. So I think that's a really, I hope that's a really simple way of thinking about it, is where this change is going to come from is from a series of very small actions. It's not going to be from just one, you know, oh, I've done this and I've never achieved net zero because I've ticked this box and it's done. It is about changing the business and how it operates in very small ways. It's not a big change, it's a series of small nudges. In terms of actions you can just get in and do, I think there are some obvious ones. One is reduce the amount of waste, as I mentioned earlier, reduce the amount of stuff you're just consuming generally. And that goes to things like energy. So insulating businesses and homes and stuff is always a good one. But that is, again, quite expensive. So I wouldn't necessarily do that as a first action. And it's going to be quite difficult if you're renting. But changing energy supplier is something that is really easy to do. Again, not the best time to be advising this, but it's a collapsing around the gas shortage in the UK. But changing energy provider is something that will take, you know, half an hour to do, really, as a business owner. And there are plenty of good companies out there doing good things. And even if you're renting, normally landlords are fairly willing to at least have a conversation about it. And, you know, it's not as easy, but it's not impossible either. And equally, installing energy meters is really useful, and, you know, smart energy meters, because that gives you an idea of your consumption, and you can start seeing patterns and behavior, and you start gathering just far more data about how your business is generating emissions and when it is generating emissions, you can start cutting down. And again, that typically translates into reduced costs as well, because if you're leaving all your computers and lights on overnight, and that's using electricity, once you've got a smart meter, you can see how much energy it's using and therefore how much money it's costing you to have those on unnecessarily. So you can start reducing that down as well. I think, you know, walking more, doing more active travel, working from home more, I think all these things just help reduce the amount of travel and road and air travel that are being generated. And I think that is something that most businesses are going to adopt to anyway, coming out of COVID, and the, you know, back to office is going to be an optional thing rather than a full 5 days a week thing. And that is going to reduce emissions down as well. So in terms of the UK economy net zero goals, I think transport accounts for about a third of emissions. It's quite a high chunk. And that is just road emissions and, you know, lorries driving around. So reducing that down is going to always help. I think the next big thing I'd probably recommend that is easy and quick to do that a lot of businesses don't think about beyond just the, you know, changing the mindset thing is pension providers and your financial institutions looking at where they are stored. Because if your pension is all investing in oil and gas technology on the North Sea, that's going to be having a fairly big part of your footprint. And pensions do come into your scope 3 emissions. They are something that is tracked as part of net zero. So it's really difficult to quantify this one in terms of percentage or tonnage that is going to have an impact on, because it's so complex and because it depends on your company and how much money you've got sloshing around in that pension fund. But changing pension providers is something I'd recommend as a fairly quick and easy thing to do as well. And then also looking at your bank and going, how is my bank investing in these things, and how to, if you're with HSBC or someone who's fairly heavily invested in oil and gas and coal and all this stuff in international markets, you want to move away from them and reduce that down as well.
Well, I think there's some good actionable ones, and some ones I hadn't thought of to track where investment and where interests are going on. Certainly makes sense. There's, yeah, money doesn't sit around doing nothing. It's working for someone else. It's producing carbon or whatever offsets. depends on how it's being used for other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think we had a really good conversation now. And as we sort of move into the end of the conversation, I mean, in terms of the UK or in terms of an industry, if you're sort of thinking a bit more general, I mean, what do you think in the challenges are for the next sort of 1 or 2 years as we head towards 2025 that either are going to be positive change or are challenges that are holding it back?
I think the answer is policy. We're in a weird position at the minute where the money's there. There's a lot of investors who see this problem coming and they're seeing the risks of their future, and therefore the money is not really, it's not too much of an issue. There's also the business side, I think, is to a certain extent sorted. There's a lot of businesses now that are on board, especially the larger companies. They see the opportunity from this and they're looking forward for the next 10 years and going, actually, there's money to be made here. We're in a position where we can take advantage of that. However, they are waiting for the policy to be written to enable them to do so. you know, and the policy is a real difficult one because it's slow moving and it's several years behind where we need to be already in terms of where the market's at. The market has kind of adapted to net zero relatively quickly and is starting to move in that direction and will only continue to do so and increase. The policy side is really lacking and there's a lack of leadership from central government. So we've got very good targets and we are one of the kind of most ambitious G20 countries in terms of our targets, which is good. You know, 2030 for the internal combustion engine being phased out is one of the most ambitious in any G20 nation. However, on the flip side of that is that we're also lagging behind in the infrastructure for electric vehicle charging. We are one of the slowest in the G20 to be rolling that out because of poor policy planning and just money being in the right places. So what we're seeing is a lot of talk, but not a lot of actual action from central government. And that's really slowing things down. And that's what I'd say is the main barrier to this. Because also I think if you did introduce certain policies like carbon emissions tracking, or, you know, if you had to do a self-assessment every year on your carbon emissions, that would just highlight and solve a lot of the problems, and solutions would form around that quite quickly, resolve those challenges that people are facing. But we don't currently have that. And I think more broadly, there is just a lack of understanding over net zero as an opportunity. And it currently feels like a threat. And it's something that is going to hamper efforts to recover from COVID, when in reality, a lot of the actions, if we talk about them ignoring the environment and we never mention the environmental part of it, people would be like, oh, that's a great idea. This is going to build a better business. The kind of problem we're at the minute, and this is something I'm trying to solve, is how do we take net zero and make it a bit sexier for business owners and not really mention it as an environmental thing? Because as soon as you say sustainability or, you know, green or tree planting, people just roll their eyes and, you know, think of Extinction Rebellion and think you're all hippie wearing vegans. That's not accurate, but it's what people think of. And that's their initial emotional response, where in reality, you want to be doing, you know, how do we really highlight that a lot of these problems that businesses are facing with net zero are intrinsic to just their business model, and they need to change how they're operating and finding better suppliers and reducing the amount of consumption and reducing the amount you're throwing out and walking more and cycling more and things like that are all going to build better lives for people. And it's about selling that better life and not selling the carbon reduction to them. That's the main challenge, I think, but we'll get there.
No, I think that's a really good thing. And just on a personal note, I mean, have you got a favourite tool, a favourite book, a favourite something that's resonating with you and being fun with you to work with at the moment?
Yeah, I think that the best book I'd get that really solidified my idea of this, and it's really simple and accessible and anyone can pick it up and read it and flick through it, is How Bad Are Bananas by Mike Berners-Lee. Just checking that's on my bookshelf, and it is the right title and name. But yeah, it's a real good, there's about the first, you know, 30 pages is all you need to read. And then the rest of it is a reference guide for how much carbon footprint are in everyday objects. So things like flying from London to Glasgow is in there, and that's where I got the figures from. But also things like plastic bags, tote bags, jeans, a meal out, a restaurant, a bath. I think he even did closing a car door, which was, you know, measuring the emissions that were generated from running the air conditioning versus the outside temperature and the air that's lost when you open the car door. He's done some fun ones like that. It's just a real good guy that brings it into a more human context in terms of where the emissions are sitting in your everyday life. And it's a great way to start thinking about it. And it also introduces the idea of a carbon budget and going, well, actually, it's not saying that you can't fly anymore. It's about saying that if you do want to fly, what are you going to sacrifice elsewhere to free up those carbon emissions? So not sacrifice, but where are you going to make those carbon savings elsewhere to free up your budget for that flight? So again, it's putting this carbon into a financial context and going, carbon emissions are a finite resource. How do we then best spend that carbon emissions to live the life we want, rather than saying that, oh, it's all about, you know, loss and sacrifice?
And therefore, a fun closer that might connect back with that or your idea on policy is a fun question of, if we can give you a superhero costume, or you can, by all means, give the superhero costume to the small business owner, what two things should you grab to come out on top and win the day if you've been backed into the corner?
That's a very good question. That's a very difficult question to answer. I think, I mean, my initial one, if I was a superhero and I could do anything, I would be getting government to set out actual policy guidelines and just sort their act out, really. You know, there's the Green Home Fund that was live for about 6 months, which was a £6 billion pot of money for insulating and installing heat pumps in homes. And that got pulled after 6 months. And it's like, well, that's what we need, but it wasn't there for long enough. So I'm not sure if it's a cheat answer, but one would be just clear long-term policy from government. And
you get to choose. You get to choose. So by all means. And what else?
That's one. And then two would be, I think, understanding net zero as an opportunity and really going, just understanding how this is going to build a better business. And that's just an understanding that's really lacking at the minute. And it's a message that isn't being transmitted out there. And I think once people realize that all of this stuff around, you know, low traffic neighborhoods and driving less and eating less meat and all that stuff, it's always being framed as being less and sacrifice and reduction at the minute, when in reality, it's actually, you're gaining a lot from that. It's not about eating less meat. It's about eating healthier local produce that supports local farmers and builds more resilient communities and means that you're healthier. It's not about driving less. It's about walking more and, again, shopping with local businesses and, you know, pedestrianizing local streets that then are nicer places to be and support small businesses and just build communities that are nicer producer and then therefore increases house prices. So it's about framing it in a personal thing and what you can gain. And that's the second thing that I'd probably choose, is just, you know, more of an understanding and more messaging around the positive actions in spite of net zero.
That's perfect. And then just to keep this actionable front going, keep you on your toes and your superior form, is where can we contact you? And what sort of initiatives or practices are you doing that can be helpful? And it's worth getting in contact with you afterwards, Adam.
Yeah, brilliant. So I think the best starting place would be on small99.co.uk. We've got a kind of carbon measurement tool, which is a really simple, non-technical, just set of 20 questions, which then gives you an idea and gets you thinking about where you can save carbon emissions in your business. And we'll then guide you through that through a couple of emails afterwards. So if you go to small99.co.uk/measure, that will get you started and that will get you just thinking about your carbon emissions. And that's the best, it's the best way to get a carbon footprint report without actually paying for it, essentially. So I'd start there.
Mm-hmm. And then again, you're available for talking to people, or are you working with people one-on-one, or just sort of more events and planning and sort of advice?
Yeah, no, always up for a conversation. So you can reach me on LinkedIn, is probably the best way to get me. If you just search for Adam Bastock on LinkedIn, and also on Small99 on the contact form, you can book a call with me as well. So if you've got very specific questions or challenges, then please do get in touch. It's always good to hear the practical experience of people kind of on the ground. And then also we are developing Small99 as a platform. And in the next few weeks, we will be launching the Small99 community so people can kind of get involved and help each other as well, rather than it just being me, you know, waffling on all the time. People can actually have conversations outside of it and, you know, use Small99 as a vehicle to see change and enact action.
Mm-hmm. And as you put it, it's not a one step, one giant leap. It's lots of little steps, and those work better in a community, and especially when you can help each other move forward.
Exactly. It's a journey that everyone's going to be on.
Great. Well, that's been really great and really educating having you join us today. So thanks again for your time, and we'll look forward to catching up again soon.
Thank you very much, and best of luck to everyone.
Thanks for joining us again today on the Cliff Notes podcast. You can find more details and show notes available on the website, cliffnotespodcast.com. And we always welcome contacts and messages sent directly from the website or over on LinkedIn or Twitter. Thank you, and see you again next time.